Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, friends. It's me, Justin Robert Young.
And Brian Brushwood.
Dude, I was in L.A. I was there. I seen it. I did it. I done walked around it, did an egg on it, pushed it up, and then went home.
I have no independent confirmation of this.
That's true, actually.
Andrew, I saw you in L.A.
Oh, mm-hmm. God dog it. Yeah.
I came out to Burbank.
I had a lot of important work to do at the beach, all right? I had to walk to the beach every day.
It's all right.
Come home every day.
I don't care. And you want to know why I don't care? Gentlemen, we have been, you know, there's been a minor topic we've occasionally addressed on this show.
Not enough,
A little bit.
Not enough. Always said we need more of this.
That's been the number one criticism, I think, from some people, is that we just don't talk about this enough, that it sometimes doesn't feel like it's a show about that. But I think since the show started, I tried to find some of the earliest examples of our discussion of this in the archives, and I got back as far as 6 years ago and even talking about the hints of what was to come. And then when the announcement that was first teased, we've been talking about this. Perhaps a little, you know, much to some people's, you know, liking, but for us, it's an exciting thing because we're a show about being skeptical, but scientific and forward thinking and thinking about things in a what could be sort of way while still trying to keep our feet planted on the ground.
Well, luckily, no news has happened in that regard, and we don't need to bring it up again.
Yep. Moving on to Goblins.
Now, seriously, folks, as you know, last week we talked about that we were going to have, this was the week of the Elon Musk announcement about his architecture for going to Mars.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this for several years. We've talked about that this was the announcement he was going to be doing at the International Astronomy Congress in Mexico. He's going to do this address and explain what his rocket system for getting there. And we have it. We've seen this. It's in front of us now. And we've had some reaction to it. And I would say that we pretty much called it as far as what some of the initial reaction is going to be about the skepticism, the not quite getting it or whatever. And there's also been enthusiasm. But really at that point where it still sort of has to sink in what's taking place. And we'll kind of address, I think, a little bit of like when that happens. Because it's not like you say we're going to do a thing and then everybody is like yay or nay. It happens in stages. And also, it's important to remember what Musk had said, that he was going to present an architecture for going to Mars, not an entire plan for a Martian city, not an entire zoning requirements, not all the other little thousands of details that have to be solved.
Yeah.
Because that's going to take tens of thousands of people solving them. And criticism. What's that?
Oh, I was going to say, let's go in order. Because we want to address like what he did say and what he didn't say. But starting off with what he did say, if I may begin with the pettiest of comments, am I the only one who's surprised that somebody who is capable of such precision spoke so, shall we say, extemporaneously on the subject? It didn't sound like the most rehearsed speech I'd ever heard. Which
have you heard of this person, Elon Musk, before, Brian?
Yeah, well, I guess I know that Elon Musk is capable of very precise, very well thought out, measured, rehearsed, practiced discussions. But could you
refer me to one of those?
Oh, is that really a style? I guess maybe I'm describing something.
Dude, I mean, listen, this is a guy who makes Austin Powers references when talking about the lasers that would be on the Dragon capsule. This is a man who not but a few hours ago tweeted out that his ex-wife is going to be an actress on Westworld and plays a good sex robot.
Killer sex robot.
We can have a discussion about his presentational style, but I don't know if that's the most important part of the discussion.
I'm starting us off slow.
This was the pettiest. Yeah. I think it is something to be said that this is the first of many high profile, kind of front page general interest kind of announcements and news stories that Elon Musk will likely be a part of if this plan continues to move forward with the architecture that he laid out. And this might have been a lot of people's initial introduction to him. But I think, you know, from what at least my perspective, this is very much in line, him making underpants gnome jokes and stuff like that.
Well, and then also like a literal line from his speech being, have you guys seen Battlestar Galactica?
It's a good show.
It's an excited engineer, you know, talking to us about this, which
sure,
is
sure,
part
sure.
of. So let's
get into what was announced.
Yeah,
let's
talk about this. So what he did is Elon Musk, basically what he said was he discussed his actual plan for the system to get people to Mars, not just an engineering solution, but an economic solution from the point of view of how do you make this thing work 1,000 trips out? Because prior, when we went to the moon, NASA was tasked with getting people to the moon in a decade, not building a reusable system for going back and forth to the moon. It cost about $2 billion per person to get them to the moon. There was no part of the plan of how to reduce that cost. And that's why we stopped going to the moon in 1972, because it was ridiculously expensive and there was no technology in there that really could radically improve the cost. We had the same problem with the space shuttle. The space shuttle started off as a reusable system, but really wasn't reusable. Parts of it were the orbiter could be reused, but you had to redo the engines, the tiles, and everything else, the boosters, and all this. It still cost you over $1 billion to $2 billion per launch. So you didn't have reusability there. And so reusability has not been a primary goal of NASA and not necessarily something it's been tasked with. It's not the fault of it. NASA has meanwhile done incredible research and technology that's going to be absolutely critical in going to Mars. Without NASA's research and stuff, wouldn't be possible. Let's make that very, very clear. But reusability, trying to build a commercial space industry, hasn't been a primary goal there. And for the people involved in the space industry, you know, when you're talking to, you know, about companies like ULA, which is an alliance between Boeing and Lockheed, they would get $1 billion a year from the government just because they need it, you know, for basically as a subsidy for what they called launch readiness, not for actual launches, but just $1 billion a year subsidy for that. When you're making that kind of money and you're able to charge $300-400 million per launch, you're not really eager to disrupt your marketplace with the reusability. So yeah. We haven't had that. That's the difference between old space and new space. New space says you've got to make these things reusable. The reason we haven't gone back to the moon, we haven't gone to Mars, is because it's too damn expensive. And we might be able to do a one-time mission for $100 billion or $250 billion, according to one of the NASA plans, but the next mission will cost just as much. I mean, reduced a little bit because of what you learn, but your capital costs are never regained. So what he showed was, and we didn't know what was going to be. We had no idea what this rocket system was going to be, or the finer points. We knew it was going to be methane-based because you can produce methane on Mars, and so refueling on Mars was critical. We weren't quite sure how many different units or parts were going to go into it, you know, and until he unveiled this video that showed what it was a surprise. Following people on the Reddit forums and my own expectations, we were surprised by how it worked.
So let's walk through kind of the broad strokes of the plan as it was presented. Is you have a two-stage rocket, slightly bigger than the Saturn V that launched men to the moon. So slightly
a booster and a spaceship.
Right, slightly taller. It's certainly much, much bigger as far as total volume. If you look at the two side by side, it looks like two or three times as large with an unprecedented, insane, I forget what the amount of thrust, 3,000 tons of thrust per second or something. But the plan as it was presented in the animation is that there's basically one main stage, giant building-sized
The booster.
The booster that would take a ship filled with humans or cargo or whatever.
We'll call it the spaceship.
The spaceship, and it would park it into low Earth orbit. The first stage would land, refuel immediately, and then launch within 24 hours with a second stage filled with fuel.
The tanker.
Basically an identical spaceship, this one filled with fuel that would come up and then put all the fuel into the spaceship, transfer it over, and then off they would go to Mars, basically, right?
Yeah, so there's a booster, which goes back and forth. There's the spaceship, we'll call it just the spaceship, and then the tanker. And the tanker does multiple refueling, because your goal is you want to get as much cargo to Mars as possible. So Musk ran... They must have gone through in his team. Again, he's got a huge team of people there at SpaceX. It's not like, as some people think, he just thought this up at Denny's, you know, the morning of the presentation. This is a plan that's been developed for a considerable amount of time. So they tried to figure out the most efficient way. And you create efficiencies through several things you need to do. One is you got to reduce the overall cost or the overall weight of your rocket. And so one of the big innovations there is using carbon fiber material and carbon fiber tanks. The carbon fiber tanks that they're using is an incredible weight saving function. When there was an attempt in the 1990s to build a rocket called the Delta Clipper, a single stage to orbit rocket, that was the deal breaker. They couldn't make a tank strong enough to contain the pressurized fuel. Tanks are important, so the super lightweight rocket's absolutely critical. An engine, a much more powerful engine, is critical, not just one that runs on methane because you can, you know, refuel on Mars, but they do the form of the way the engine works is basically it doesn't need other fuel, doesn't need other systems like helium or whatever to pressurize it. It uses the flow of the oxygen and the methane, the combustion from that, to fuel the turbo pump, which pushes the fuel through the rocket. So it is an incredibly powerful engine. And as Musk was doing this, revealing this, you know, he pointed out that they tested this Raptor engine, this new technology engine. They had their first test last Sunday, a week ago. They showed this thing actually working, so it wasn't theoretical. He then, which was shocking to me and many people, was he unveiled the first tank they produced, this full-size tank that's like 30 feet across, this carbon fiber tank, because he said these are the hardest pieces of tech. And so the point, and then the other thing that's really critical to this is that, so you as Brian pointed out, the tanker goes up like four or five times, fuels up the spaceship, so it's max capacity. Then the spaceship turns on the engines, leaves Earth orbit, heading off at an incredible velocity, something around 50,000 miles per hour, about twice what we've been planning on going to Mars before, by the way, heads towards Mars. And then this is a really critical point that was lost on a number of people. And in fact, there's a Jalopnik article that came out there by Joshua Torchinsky. And Josh and I have been talking back and forth about this. And Josh is excited about this, but he, like other people, kind of missed a very critical detail about how Musk's system works. Instead of, as it gets halfway to Mars, turning around and turning on the engines to slow down, you know, do a deceleration burn, or close to Mars, do a deceleration burn to enter Mars orbit, which is how just about every other proposal we've ever seen to putting man to Mars has involved. Every serious proposal has done that, which means you use half your fuel to leave Earth orbit, then about half your fuel to slow down, because remember, you're going 50,000 miles an hour. And the only way to slow down is either to crash into Mars, you know, or use fuel, or the other option, which is what this does, is it uses aerocapture, which we've used on probes. And that means you need a really, really high heat-resistant underside so that you hit the Martian atmosphere and you use the Martian atmosphere to slow you down instead of burning fuel. And then you slow down on the Martian atmosphere and you can either then go into an orbit or you can go land using a much, much smaller amount of fuel. That's a critical point. It's an absolutely critical point that's been lost on a lot of people who've been addressing this or criticizing it. What that means is that you can go to Mars twice as fast, or you can just use half as much fuel to get there. It also means, and this is a very important factor that I think has been forgotten by people who sort of criticize this, when you leave Mars, when the spaceship leaves Mars and heads back to Earth, it needs just enough fuel to leave Mars orbit at a Mars, you know, escape velocity. It doesn't need to have the fuel then on return to Earth to slow down. So it reduces the fuel requirements by half, and it gives you twice the speed.
So this is a case where by having superior sensors, superior artificially intelligent or precise calculations, basically if your aim is precise enough, there's giant chunks of fuel you don't need to slow down because you basically target it so precisely that you're able to hit that thin band of atmosphere and use that as a giant picture a bunch of giant foam slowing you down. It's like that dude who jumped out of the airplane and landed in a net. If you can be precise, you don't even need a parachute because you can land right in the net.
So it's a critical technological component is they have a technology called Pika X, which was developed, or Pika was originally developed by, or Pika was developed by NASA as a new form of heat shielding. SpaceX took this and they said, you know, we don't want to just be able to use this two or three times. We want to use this multiple times. And we want this to handle the reentry velocities coming from Mars or anywhere else in the solar system. So what they developed was this very, very robust system. And also, when you're trying to plan the economics of this, you know, some people said, well, why not have five tankers? Well, at $250 million a piece, you're adding over $1 billion to the cost and the storage and all that. This isn't a theoretical thing. It's not a theoretical argument for Musk. He's literally looking at blueprints, literally looking at capacity, factory capacity, manpower, engineering, et cetera, and saying, okay, if I have this many resources, what's the best way to do this? And other people have said, like, why not just leave everything in Mars orbit and have a separate lander? Andy Weir, you know, said, well, I would have like five landing ships, you know, in one big thing. And it's like, well, where are they inside the bigger vessel? Because then you got to build, you know, a whole other system to contain them. If they're out attached on the outside, you can't do aero capture. Well, and I don't think
this is the problem with everybody who is piping in right now is they're all piping in thinking about this problem for their first, maybe second, third, fourth, or Andy Weir's, you know, 10,000th few minutes, but none of us have a team of engineers to actually run the numbers and say this is a doable, scalable and marvel.
I think there's also just a difference between thinking of this and what Andrew is getting at, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that this is not a theoretical issue as in, okay, let's create a plan that works and then let's go to an unlimited checkbook to fill it out. This is about, you know, when Musk says $150,000 or $200,000 to go to Mars, like that number comes from how much it costs to do. And then there is just a fundamental difference in thinking from, hey, here's a balance sheet. We need to make sure that this cost gets down to this and it is still as reliable and safe and efficient as it possibly can be. And hey, let me just figure out in a blue sky how I would do this. And I think that there is just this fork in the road right now where you have a lot of people who are either, not seeing Musk's vision or have their own. But I don't know if any of them are thinking quite in the way that Elon Musk is about, like, hey, no, this is about price. This is about making sure that this thing functions at a certain budget, or else the entire idea of what he is pitching with an architecture and a framework for this is, you know, we want to make sure that people live on Mars, that there are businesses on Mars, that there is culture that thrives. That doesn't happen unless this is a cost efficient thing to do.
Which, by the way, to me was one of the most powerful points. And let's begin with the supposition that all of his math is right and everything's going to be fine. We're going to get to the criticism.
It works in Kerbal Space Program, so
it works for us. But like understand, we are going to talk about all the criticisms. But to me, one of the most remarkable parts of it is when he says, number one, the big moments for me is the two stage. You know, send the same ship up twice. The same booster up twice to get the payload up there and then the fuel up there. The second is the idea of an entire fleet moving at once, which solves all kinds of things regarding redundancy, regarding social aspects to it or whatever. And then the third part is that really stuck out to me was the fact that the estimates are, what, $140,000 to $200,000 per seat? Like if you're somebody in your mid 40s who owns his own house, you can shrug, decide to sell your house and go to Mars. Again, this is optimistically assuming everything works out.
Yeah, well, I mean, one is honest, the fleet thing is decades away, and that's more of just that when you want to start moving a lot of people there, when you have every 2 years the Martian, you know, the closest period of which the Martian transfer window, and you want to get as many people as there as possible, you'll need to have fleets. It's not so much as a matter of redundancy for the mission there at all, because it'll be decades before we do that. It's more of just when you want to move that many people there, you have a limited amount of time in which you can do that. As far as like in the selling your house to go to Mars, you know, the first decade or two, if you've got the skills, there will be somebody to hire you and pay for you to go there. Well, you know, the first few ships aren't going to be filled with families and people like that who are just like putting on their little hobo sack and like, I'm going to go to Mars and strike out and figure out what's going out there. You know, it's going to be engineers and scientists and researchers.
Right. It's going to be Google commissioning two or three ships worth and then sending their youngest and brightest to set up the Google outpost on Mars.
I mean, well, also look at it this way. When I moved out here to the Bay Area, the Go Game paid probably about $5,000 worth of moving costs for me, right? To go across the country to run scavenger hunts. Like the idea that you could go to what would be a very, very important and specifically financially lucrative outpost on Mars and you know, basically have your life uprooted, you know, not only away from your family across an ocean, but across the stars. you know, that's huge. I mean, but it's not crazy. I mean, like this, the idea that there are jobs right now that have $150,000 bonuses to sign on the dotted line.
Yeah, like, and we can get into some of that and what it means to really work at Pizza Hut on Mars and at that in a few moments. But let's just let me just close this part of it saying that it is a very, very fascinating plan. It is worth looking at in detail and understand that there is we've had a number of criticisms and stuff forwarded to us that everything that I've seen other than the why should we go or whatever should we go kind of things, which come down to subjective arguments. And I think ignore the tremendous economic potential, the amazing economic potential. And I'll explain kind of a simple way to frame that. Didn't pay attention, didn't, you know, read the plan. They didn't read the plan and understand what it is, understand that. And there's old space like Robert Zubrin, who had, a very ambitious idea for Mars Direct to get humans to Mars as quickly as possible as head of this Mars Society. He had his improvement, which you read it through, and he's still thinking old space. It's about how to get there kind of once. And he's like, I would just leave the habitats there and send the rockets back. And it's like, well, who's paying for that? You know, it's like for a guy that spent the last 30 years, you know, or more, you know, championing us getting to space or getting to Mars, his thinking is just get humans there, not let's build an economic infrastructure to keep doing that. So that's the kind of thinking you're going to encounter is old space versus new space. New space is Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos fielding humongously large rockets, not because of their egos, because they fundamentally understand that a 747 is a much more efficient way to transport people than a two-person Cessna or the Wright brothers airplane. It's not a matter of I'm going to build a bigger rocket. It's a matter of if you want to make this thing work and economically viable, you have to take advantage of economies of scale.
Yes, they certainly do not do it for their egos, although I'm sure their egos get a very lovely ride along the way.
We had in 1 week, we had two different billionaires send us pictures of, you know, show us pictures of their rockets, like these rocket pics.
Hey, you up? Question mark. I have a question, a technical question, because even reading through some of the criticism, the one thing that seems to be non-controversial or at least has sort of almost been glossed over, it was the thing that I found the most fascinating, which is just this idea of the booster going up, coming down, and going back up again after being reloaded in a short period of time. How much was that on the radar leading into this announcement? And is this that to me seemed to be the breakthrough. That to me seemed to be the thing that opens up and unlocks so much, no matter what your plan is about the tankers and the spaceships and how you're going to handle everything. That to me seemed like that was worth the price of admission just watching the announcement.
Absolutely. The critical technologies, one was reusability booster, and that would probably been the one people would have said was the deal breaker, would say that, well, we don't have the ability to send stuff up and bring it back down. Musk and Bezos have demonstrated that, and that would have, if we had not had those demonstrations from, if they had not been bringing back down Falcon 9 first stages, and we hadn't seen New Shepard come back down from the Kármán line, not yeah. from orbital velocity, but still come down, that would be the one, be like, we've never done this, it sounds expensive. I guarantee you that would be the biggest criticism right now. People would say, well, that can't be done. It cannot be done. And that's why Musk set out very early on to prove that that could be done and was investing tens of millions of dollars of SpaceX's resources to doing this thing while he had already a viable business. And that was to sort of prove that and then move on to the other technologies. We tend to ignore the things we don't understand. And so if somebody says, oh, this is a key and we don't know what it means, the carbon fiber skin technology, the advancements they've made, the heat technology, the engine systems, all these things are super, super critical. But yeah, reusability was... that was the biggest thing. And so what Musk came forward to say was, I believe I've solved the big engineering questions. And then people throw out, what about radiation? What are those things? And then he gets criticized, called delusional or whatever, for the quote, glossing that over. Well, it's like, those were problems we knew the answers to. They're not necessarily easy problems, but we knew the answers to. You know, how do you solve the radiation problem? Number one, get them faster. So Musk puts people on Mars twice as fast as previous plans. Number two, this is new space. This is a humongous rocket that could carry 100 people or eventually 200 people. you don't have to worry. You know, previous missions to Mars where they worried about radiation were very, very tiny tin can sized things where you could not afford a lot of radiation shielding in the form of water or thicker walls or whatever. You can do that at this scale. You know, it's like a balloon. It's exponentially bigger, which means within there you can have a small space that's, you know, your cargo space is enough. You can solve this problem. And we also have there's electromagnetic systems that actually have been tested at the laboratory for providing, you know, your own little magnetosphere to protect you from radiation. So it's like, yeah, these are real problems, but they're not the scale of the problem that we had to deal with in reusability. And that's the thing that's, I would say, frustrates me is some of the criticisms are, well, you know,
Specifically, it's reading the articles that are giving specific I don't know how to describe it. Basically, the people who are bitching and whining are bitching and whining about things that were not part of the presentation. He did not title the presentation "A Method to Get Humans to Mars Cheaply," and also a meditation upon all of the ramifications, socioeconomic and otherwise, that you're going to have to deal with on that. So it's like many of the articles that you're seeing that are negative are like, he didn't even talk about how marriage is going to work on Mars. And it's like, yeah, yes, because that is outside the scope of the talk that he meant to give.
Yeah. And also what he wants is that, you know, we're going to need tens of thousands of people coming up with really brilliant solutions. And if you were a company that was already developing life support systems, or if you're scientists or researchers working on radiation shielding, you would have a much more difficult time of getting enthusiasm about that in a world where going to Mars was a ridiculous absurdity that maybe happened in the 2030s or 2040s. Now that this is more of reality, we're going to see a bunch of startups form to solve these problems. I promise you, given the excitement that happened over Hyperloop, which was an example used last week, now that we have this architecture, we know privately behind the scenes, private capital has expressed an interest in that. And I'm just as an aside, is there's this one like Elon Musk unveils his $10 billion plan for a rocket, but how's he going to pay for it? And I look at it like man worth $12 billion announces $10 billion plan. His goal is not to spend his wealth, you know, to lose control of his companies until he has to, but he is committed to spending whatever he can to do it, but he won't need to. He won't need to. You know, the idea that for 10, he says at $10 billion, they'll start seeing return on the investment. Not that it's only going to cost $10 billion, it costs a lot more. But once they build this booster and they build this spaceship that can then go into low Earth orbit, can go to the moon, it can put the most it can carry basically, you know, the entire International Space Station up in one trip.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
All right, so let's get into the idea of, because that was one of the criticisms. Let's can we delve into some of what came up over the week? I'm looking at our flow chart here. Although I do think that he didn't answer all the questions. He said that there was going to be a tavern on the spaceship, but are there going to be bucket specials? And what's the menu?
Is it going to have a gluten free menu?
Yeah, is it going to be craft gastropub style, or maybe
before
French,
we get into the
Mexican? Come on,
before
answer the question. What's last call in the space tavern?
I do really, really like that there was at least a nod to the social aspect of what it's going to mean to go to Mars, because I was surprised, and I was there with Justin when we were watching it. I was surprised how once you set aside the questions about economic feasibility, technical feasibility, you think in terms of like, okay, how do you physically make this a tolerable journey, and how do you make it something that people want to sell their house to go to Mars? And a big part of it is you make it super attractive. You make Mars culture, and you make the moment that ship leaves Earth, the most interesting stuff in the universe needs to be on that ship to those people.
Yeah. So, and also, is it going to be Coke or Pepsi? Because this is a major issue. I'm going to be on the ship for a long time.
So a thing to think about, too, is that as we get into the more of the idea of living on Mars, they're going to be phased. You know, there's the first 10 years on Mars are going to be very different than the next decades after that. You know, it's going to be a very, very different. And I've had a conversation with people, who's going to want to go there? It's like this. I'm like, yeah, there's people who are going to want to go there in the first 10 years. And that's not going to be somebody who's thinking about like, you know, maybe I want to do a sabbatical and focus on my art and do some, you know, me work. You know, no, it's going to be, you know, scientists and researchers and engineers and explorers and stuff. That's who we need in that first decade or so. And that's going to be, Mars is not going to be as fun as it can be, or the Mars they build. So that's a thing to keep in mind. Mars is a changing, evolving thing. But on the subject of Brian, what you talked about, watching that rock, like up until that announcement, I had zero interest in going into space, you know, because like for me, the idea is, do I really want to be strapped inside of a small little rocket or whatever? My vision, what I was thinking of was maybe like a slightly larger version of like, you know, the Dragon crew capsule stacked in there like a bus. I had no idea he was literally building a rocket to carry 100 people up into orbit. And then when you see the images of that, not to say, oh, it's going to be fun and pleasant or whatever, but it's a very, it's more like Star Trek than right. what we've seen before. And then he revealed the fact that this spaceship with fuel depots in other parts of the solar system could go to every part of the solar system. It could go to visit Jupiter. It could land on the moons of Jupiter. It could land in Enceladus. It could land on all these other hard surfaces there. It could go all the way out to the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud. I mean, this he unveiled a spaceship that literally can go to the outer reaches of our solar system with plenty of room for people in there.
So the part that surprised me, that bubbled up in my mind, because when you now that we have a concrete idea to wrap our minds around, one of the things that popped into my mind is like, okay, so it's what, 3-4 times or as big as 2 747s? Is that how big it is?
I think that's the total volume area, something like that, 247s or
so, 747s. Okay, so imagine being in there for 3 months at a time. That's a challenging thing. But then I think about like little things like, man, is it going to matter that virtual reality is a viable technology now that you know, having been hands on with the Vive, and I think about things about like getting claustrophobic and feeling trapped and like I can't go anywhere. If you can get enough of that outside feeling experience, if you can strap on some, you know, high quality, you know, 12th generation Vive or whatever, and experience just being out under the bright blue sky, you know, with as much room as you can imagine to explore, or being at a concert with a loved one, all of a sudden it changes what I imagine myself as being capable of doing in terms of locking myself up in a stinky tin can with other people.
And think about, too, that you have when we think about like the volume of like 2 747s or whatever, those things each have like 300 people on board. They have 600 people in there. And in the first plans, Musk is talking about putting 100 people on board. So you have five times the amount of space. But then you have to remember, too, you're in space, you're in microgravity. So you're able to utilize more of that space. You don't build seats on the, you know, you don't build beds on the roof of the 747 because you can't do that. And also the things that you need or you don't need. It was funny as I was reading, I've been reading a lot of discussions about this, and somebody did an analysis of, you know, found out like, yeah, you know, you could actually have like a little, there's enough room for everybody to have their own little kind of micro room based upon what they've done in like passenger cabins and cruise ships and stuff. And they said, that'd be room enough for a bed, a table, and a chair. And then without realizing, yeah, guess what? Three things are absolutely useless.
Yeah,
in zero gravity.
A table and a chair, exactly.
Yeah. That was when I wrote my book Station Breaker. I had to get out of the mindset of like, you know, like, oh, he, you know, he goes into a room. He doesn't walk into a room. And then how do you work at a workstation? You don't sit in a chair at a workstation because a chair requires, you know, strapping yourself in or whatever. You just attach yourself with a harness to sort of float there. So it's a very, very different way to think about things. And when you start looking at how they work on the ISS, you know, they have laptop stations, you have stations, you work at a station. And on this, like, yeah, I imagine you're going to have little micro, you know, cubes that you can go sleep inside of. Either you have your own or it's a time-shared one, because a third of your people are going to be, could be asleep at any given time if you're working in cycles, but I'm sure there are going to be times that everybody wants to kick together and do stuff. Your space is very, very different. And yeah, as Brian says, virtual reality and these technologies, you know, you're able to make these things not look austere and frightening and boring. You can make them very, very livable. There's going to be a tremendous amount of effort spent on making this thing a fun. Musk was jubilant, like, oh, it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. We're going to zero gravity games. Or he's planning. He's already like planning the cruise director stuff for there, you know.
Well, and which is a not insignificant aspect of this. It's mm-hmm. tempting to say that, oh, he's being Pollyanna about this. No, it matters. Psychological health of people in a very daunting journey matters if you want to make this an attractive proposition.
Andrew's going to pay for all this. We're talking about zero gravity games and all this stuff. Man, this is a $10 billion plan that will probably overrun past that if any project of this scale is any kind of guide. Listen, I mean, who's going to pay for all this?
So you have a couple different costs you have. You have the developmental cost of building the rocket system and getting the first one up and running.
Time out real quick. I just realized that wasn't a Patreon segue. I thought for sure that was a Patreon segue, and now I'm realizing it's not.
Yeah. Well, it was sufficiently funded. We could pay for it.
Yes, exactly.
Let's actually do that real quick. Patreon.com/weirdthings. It was a Patreon setup. Patreon.com/weirdthings. It wasn't until Brian said so. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Go fund us, huh? Everybody, we're talking. We're having a good time on a Sunday afternoon. Be a part of it. It's up to you. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Andrew, who's going to pay for all this?
So there are different things that have to be paid for. As far as the development of the rocket system itself, that's going to be, you know, SpaceX has already started development of that because Musk wanted to show how far along they were. He says it in roughly time frame wise. And by the way, the time frame of this is he's given an extremely ambitious time frame that has, you know, could have the first rocket launching in like 8 years or something, which he says, admittedly, he hasn't been very good at time frames. But what's an 8 year time frame in for something like this? If we slip by 10 years, really still amazing and awesome. But the first thing is building that rocket system, which he says it'll cost about $10 billion before he sees return. Now, that rocket system, by the way, can launch a new class of payloads into orbit. If you want to have your 2001 Space Odyssey spinning space station, this is the technology you'll need for it. Now, he might need to have, you know, the booster can help do this, and so he'll have to have technologies for doing kind of different payload operations and stuff, but that's all doable with that. He sees the economics of that. In 10 years, in $10 billion worth of expenditure, he thinks, to get there. And what's funny is that Andy Weir, who is a super, super nice guy, and if you ever get a chance to meet him, and he wrote a very, very, very fun book, was saying, like, I think Musk may be really off about the cost of building the rockets or whatever like that. Maybe so. But let's not forget that Elon Musk actually build rockets, you know, has actually been doing this now for 15 years. So, you know, 14 years. So it's like Musk has, if I'm going to listen to the opinion of anybody on the cost of developing this rocket technology, probably Elon Musk. You know, I think he's probably got a good grip on that.
Sure. So real quick, do we have an updated estimate on what the price per pound is? We know that he said about $140,000 to $200,000 per seat. For
$70 per pound of Mars.
$70 per pound of Mars. That's extraordinary.
Start working out. Save a little cash.
Okay, so you realize longtime listeners will know that we've had heated arguments about whether or not a space elevator is better than rockets and so on. But one of the things that I grew up reading was that with a space elevator, the cost to orbit, now keep in mind, when I was in college, it was $10,000 a pound. And then the idea was that a space elevator could get it as low as $100 a pound. And now we are in an actual, real-life, tangible situation where we're below that imaginary $100 per pound number for an imaginary system to get to orbit. And instead, we have a practical one that's even cheaper than that estimate. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, and remember, that space elevator thing takes you to geosynchronous orbit and doesn't – the problem I've had with the space elevator thing – and again, I'm not saying we couldn't have one.
Get back at it.
One, you would need a really, really inexpensive form of rocket propulsion to get you up and to be able to do this. And then you still need a rocket to take you beyond Earth orbit to other places.
Right.
So, you know, that's been one of the things, and, you know, one of the things that's sort of been overlooked, old space versus new space. And there's a documentary, Skyline, all about that, which is, you know, presents, I think, some of the faulty arguments. But it's a very interesting story of people who've been passionate about that. So you have this technology that can take us everywhere, you know, all the really cool places in the solar system. You look at the images of this, of, you know, people exploring, you know, the different moons of Jupiter, et cetera. And it's a very ambitious, excitable thing. But paying for it short term is this rocket system by itself is a revenue generating thing. It's not just because of selling tickets to Mars. I just mean putting things into low Earth orbit. And if you have the ability to say, hey, we can put, if you want to charter the spaceship rocket, you know, the SpaceX system to go to, you know, to use our booster when we're not using it, you know, every 2 years to put our Martian rockets towards Mars, that booster technology is going to be here. and the tanker technologies are going to be on Earth and can be used for other systems and stuff. And so that's an incredible economic model, and that's what's been lacking from every other single Mars proposal until now, was this, here's how it pays for itself. I've built this train system, I've built these tracks, and when I send that train off to across country, I still get to use these tracks locally for doing all this important stuff in this area.
Well, and that's the important thing. I got really miffed. One of the friends of the show, I lost the email, from the UK sent us some links, you know, to temper our enthusiasm. But the first of them that I read concludes with the question, why? Why do we need to be a multi-planet species? And the answer I would assume that Elon Musk would give is, I don't care. Do you want a ticket or not? Like, that's the thing. When you build a nobody needed to understand why anybody would want to get on a train and go all the way across the continental United States. Why you were doing that was your business. Maybe you want to go to Mars so you can set up a secure facility that that archives family genealogical data at an extraordinary cost in a secure facility. Maybe you want to protect secrets. Maybe you want to do microgravity research. Maybe you want to try to, you know, secretly terraform the planet and pollute it and corrupt. That's the best part, is when you're the guy running the train system, you don't care why anybody goes.
Why do you want to get out of bed in the morning?
Why? I've read all the literature. Allegedly, the sun is shining and it's a beautiful day in autumn. Yeah. But I
absolutely believe that a lot of the people who are eager to go are probably not the best to go initially. And a lot of people do have this very romantic idea of what it will be like. And planning the first decade or two of exploration is going to involve building simulations on Earth and disabusing people of what it will be like. But, you know, I dated a girl who was a marine geologist, brilliant, you know, and if you told her, hey, I'm going to send you to a tiny little shack in Antarctica that's 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet. You're only going to get allowed out 1 hour per day inside of a pressure suit to go grab some rocks and bring them back to your shack. She would be thrilled. She would be absolutely thrilled to do that, you know, and she married somebody else who is totally into that, and they're extremely happy. There are a lot of people like that who, you know, their value proposition's very different from the extreme cynics about this.
By the way, it was Dominic in the UK. I'm apologizing. I'm sorry I couldn't come up with your name right at the moment, Dominic.
Yeah, that was And then the economics argument, I put up a post on that, and it's now being expanded into a book. It'll be available later this month, by the way, called How to Make Money on Mars, A Guide to the Martian Economy, or Guide to Martian Economics.
Oh, that's brilliant.
To explain, you know, because I wanted to get into, this is the thing you need to think about when you want to talk about why go from an economic point of view. We don't need to find unobtainium like on Avatar. And the funny thing about Avatar is the potential biotechnology worth of everything they found was far greater than that substance. You don't need that. Think Mars, as pointed out by the critics and kind of not quite as seen anything, Mars is a technology problem. Mars is a technology problem. And when you address a technology problem, you create new technologies. To give you a small example of that, if you're trying to figure out how to develop something that can live, you know, deal with an extreme environment, you take Dean Kamen, creator the Segway, his project to take his technology for better. He created a better technology for purifying water for home dialysis. And then he wanted to take that and make it available to people in the third world so they could have clean water. Millions of people die every year from dirty water. And Dean Kamen thought if he was going to solve a problem, clean water would be a great solution for that. And so he invested some money in the technology to do that. But it had trouble kind of taking off until Coca-Cola came along and said, hey, we have these machines we want to put in every single fast food restaurant that lets you have Diet Coke, Coke, whatever you want, that just takes the water, pushes it through this cartridge system and does that. But we want to make sure our water is absolutely pure and clear and tastes the same, because we got to use the water locally, but purifying that water and having really, really quality, you know, water filtration is key. So they financed Dean Kamen's project, and Dean Kamen in exchange got, you know, Coca-Cola's help and figured out how to put his water purification systems in countries that are, you know, ricks, you know, being ravaged by civil war, et cetera. And so we have solving one tiny little problem of how do you solve this problem of livability or filtration, et cetera, had far-reaching billion-dollar implications just in one little tiny industry. When we try to address all the other technological things involved with Mars, it's not your money from Mars is partially becomes from research done on Mars. There's going to be tremendous research on there, but all of the ancillary technologies developed from solving those problems. And I don't mean it in like the Tang argument where you point to one little thing. Hey, we got this little spin out. I mean, the direct problems you solve there have direct applications on Earth.
Well, so let's speculate wildly on who wants to go to Mars, who should go to Mars. How do we determine what are they going to do when they get there?
Well, we're going to have to ask Bryce that, because if you do fund us, you know, on our Patreon, we're going to send Bryce to Mars as our corporate staff.
Okay. Man, I'm going to need some time off, Brian.
We're going to load your cabin up with some Carly Rae Jepsen and send you on your way.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. It's sounding better all the time.
I want to give it a little aside. People bring up Tensor Guy brought up the Velcro argument and the Tang argument. The problem with those arguments traditionally has been NASA didn't really make much money from those. NASA has made very little money from technology transfers because it's really hard to quantify that. And when NASA has gone to Congress and says, hey, give us $100 billion for this, you know, they can say to those things, but they've never been able to actually point to them on a balance sheet or a bottom line. Well, whereas a venture capital firm can do, you know, if you're Paul Allen and Vulcan Ventures and you're, you know, in that case, you know, perhaps perceived as a patent troll in some regards or whatever, maybe not the best situation, but if you're actually directly involved in the technology of doing this and you have a, you know, a profit participation in there, those arguments carry so much more weight.
Well, but also if your goal is to create the next Tang and Velcro, then dollar per dollar, you're much better off spending it on a think tank who just, you know, sits there and does.
Trying to actually create a better
Velcro and Tang,
a sticky surface thing.
Yeah, I mean, creating some startups or investing some startups to do that. But so, I mean, back to your question, Brian.
Well, the question is like who's going to go? What are they going to do? And what's it going to look like?
Okay, so one of the beautiful things to think about, and one of the important parts of this was the idea that Musk promises everybody who goes, you get a return ticket. So if 2 years, you have 2 years between the orbital windows in which you can come back. If you send the first crew of people there, and then half of them are upset, the next time the rocket, you know, next rocket that comes there, you hop on board and you wave goodbye and you go home. And that ability to say, I only have to do a 2-year commitment. And there's a lot of things in life are based upon 2-year commitments, you know, military service, certain degrees of education, et cetera.
Offshore drilling operations where people
absolutely.
Go out. Yeah.
When it's socially acceptable to abandon your child. Like
So that makes it it's instead of being a one way, I'm going to go there and have to spend the rest of my life there. It can be like, I'm going to spend 2 years there and like, you know, spend half a year there, half a year way back. So it's, you know, it's a 3-year commitment or so, you know, and it's like, hey, like, I went to Mars, spent a couple years there. You know, like, how was it? It was cool. You know, like I spent 6 months in Japan and lived mostly in my hotel room and, you know, I had a lot of fun time there and I love to go back, you know, and so that's doable. That's very doable in Earth lifespans right now. And if we look 10 years from now or 20 years from now, as our lifespans increase or our productive periods of our lives, as our 40s and 50s become like our 30s and 40s and so forth, that's easy. That's a no-brainer, you know, if you know that your chances of dying aren't, you know, too high. But they will be high early on. As Musk told us. Musk says, like, yeah, it's going to be a really high – it's going to be a very risky proposition.
We're going to another planet. A lot of people are going to go because it's a way to you're going to have companies like Facebook and Google that want to just establish a beachhead on this new fertile territory. They will pay a lot of money to young people or maybe even not young people, just people with expertise to help make that happen. And it may be very, very not glorious work, you know, running a digging machine or taking samples or fixing AI robots and stuff. But you know that you're going to do it for 2 years and come out. And when you get back home, it'll be a 4-year total trip between all the preparation and when you're done. But then at the end of that 4-year commitment, you know you're going to have an annuity that'll take care of you and your kids forever or whatever.
Yeah. You know, and let's talk about like what would it mean to be working in the Mars Pizza Hut, you know, in 15 years from now? If you lived on Mars, you lived there. And one of the things we can get into how, you know, one of the first things you're going to start doing is – building bigger habitats. We might be bringing like, you know, Bigelow sort of habitats, these inflatable habitats there, covering them with dirt for radiation proofing. You're one of the first goals these first colonists are going to be doing is going to be building bigger places to live. There's obviously the energy production, the in-situ, you know, fuel thing, building bigger spaces to live. And if you want to live, you can bring your structures there. Then you start using mixtures of your structures and local Martian materials. Third phase is using what you find on Mars to start building things, either using Martian material. And fourth phase or third phase is taking existing things like lava tubes. You have lava tubes. There are networks of lava tubes on Mars that probably go on for thousands of miles, okay? You just have a 1 mile segment of that that's 300 or 400 feet across, that's a few, you know, 20, 30 feet underground, and you can start building an amazing ecosystem inside of there. Mars will be greener even inside of these systems than it is on Earth. People say, well, I'm going to miss, what about the sky and what about the trees? You know, you go to Disney and you see what they've done inside of closed systems to recreate that. On Mars, they're going to be doing that on a much more massive scale. So you can start creating environments there that are very, very, you can create things that feel like, you know, the Hobbiton, you know, the Shire. You can create these sorts of environments that are extremely green, extremely livable places to visit. And then the beauty of Mars is that you can have one Mars city here, 20 miles away, you can build a different habitat. You could go into a canyon and glass it over. You could build things, you know, up on top of, you know, volcanoes or mountain ranges and stuff. You can create a variety of habitats. So one of the things that you do if you work at the Mars Pizza Hut is you're going to spend a lot of time exploring Mars. You're probably going to be volunteering or spending time, you know, doing research missions and stuff, exploring caverns, looking at rocks, trying to find fossils to see if there's things like that, looking at all the different kind of, you know, what do you do when you live in Colorado? You go mountain biking, you do this sort of stuff.
Dude, we don't have to theoretically wonder what it's like to work at a Pizza Hut in Mars, because you could just call 724-742-2662
and Mars, Pennsylvania.
You could just ask somebody who's working there. My guess is it'll be very similar.
I have family in Mars.
If I'm presenting a Pollyanna-ish sort of presentation of this, it is a counter reaction to the extreme negative, we're never going to go, why ever kind of thing. It's because it is the dream and the hopefulness is what will motivate us to do this. There's reasons, you know, we're all sitting in a country that was founded by people. Well, the first phase was founded by people leaving another continent because they were looking for better opportunities as the climate changed and they came to North America throughout South America.
I guess that's the weird part, right? Is that the whole question of why go, the answer is, I don't care. Do you want a seat or not? And my guess is that all kinds of people, for reasons we will never understand, will be lining up to sell their homes in order to get a ticket to be part of something new. Whatever this tabula rasa blank slate is, leave your life behind and become somebody totally new in the beginning of something else. You could be the first Martian poet, the first Martian magician. Yeah, you know, whatever. You could be.
God, I hope not.
Yeah.
and I think that early on, it's that if you want to go to Mars and you're going, oh, but like $200,000 and you're a young person right now, get skills, study engineering, study life support technology, study these things that are going to be critical, because I think like Facebook and Google want to be there. But I mean, really, it's going to be, you know, the primary drivers of that economy, I think, are going to be industrial companies, are going to be exploration companies. It's going to be Exxon. It's going to be biotech. It's going to be companies looking for all these ancillary things and just hardware technology companies, because Mars will become this example. Mars is how we colonize the rest of the solar system. Mars will become, you know, like Singapore's, you know, trying to become for biotech. Our Silicon Valley is for information technology. Mars becomes another technology center for all of that.
Dude, and that's actually a really good point, because like Hong Kong, understand, has virtually no natural resources. What it had was the peculiar position of being a place where the British would pretty much drink tea and enforce contracts. And in that space, it became an economic superpower, because it became a place where everybody knew they could trade and everybody would have to stick to the trade agreements that they had made.
All right, so quick question. Let's do a survey here. Bryce, too. Knowing what you know now, and if the $200,000 ticket was going to be paid for you, you know, because you were going to have a job on Mars, you knew your expectation was you're going to be spending a 40-hour work week doing something you enjoyed, you're going to be living in a Mars where, you know, let's say a 10-year out from now or whatever, where they have some really nice habitats. They've got really cool sort of Earth. Like you don't want to just make it a copy of Earth. You want to make Mars with the cool things about Earth and the cool things about Mars, but some really cool, like maybe imagine a several mile long habitat with a little river down there and trees and light coming through and little small houses and stuff. Who's going? All I'm asking for is a 40 month commitment. Your kids are grown.
I mean, can I tell you, like, real talk? I was sad briefly when I realized I was too old to go to Mars. But then he started talking about Elon started talking about, like, no, there should be a return trip. It should be the kind of thing that you could always come back. And I realized that at the age of 51, I am too old. I'm already first of all, I'm 41 now, but I'll be 51 10 years from now, and I'll be too old to homestead. Also had a vasectomy, so I will not be very useful for making Martian babies. But there's probably something that it's worth me being there for 2 years to lend a hand on doing. And I think, like, from age 51 to age 54, I think I could dedicate that chunk of my life to going and just pitching in on setting up Mars. I think I would love that. Absolutely. 100% I would go.
And a thing to think about, too, as far as age, is you understand that your 50 is going to be a lot more like what somebody's 40 was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Just the advances have been made there. And your ability, like what we know now, like, when you look at Hollywood actors who, like, get beefed up to play, like, superhero roles and things like that, they're not using steroids. There's a lot of new technology for health. If you're 40 years old and you care about your health, you can do a lot of things now that you couldn't do before. That's why you look at, you look at the number of, you know, Hugh Jackman's considered sort of this high example. That guy's closer to 50.
And, yeah. You look at side by side, and maybe Bryce can actually call this up, look at Hugh Jackman playing Wolverine in 2001 or 2002 versus him playing it in the most recent movie. He is in every way a superior specimen of the human body, of the human physique now than he was back then.
We've had John Glenn was the oldest person in space so far, 77 years old when John Glenn went into space, first American to orbit the Earth. And then he went back into space at 77 years of age. We've had shuttle commanders, I think, in their 60s. So your usability is going to be extreme. And I also think that you're going to have some of the best candidates for going there are going to be people in their 50s and stuff who are healthy, extremely healthy, and who have accomplished stuff on Earth. And they're looking to do sort of not retire, not the opposite of retire, but people who are have a lot of knowledge and, you know, the temperament for that.
I'm in, man. I lived in Hoboken.
And I was like, nah, I don't think I want to do it. But then understanding really what the context of this looks like now and the fact that I get the return and do all that, I don't think I want to spend the rest of my life on Mars. And I think that's a thing we have to think about, too, is the goal of this really isn't like, hey, just go to Mars and you're done, is that as you go there and as we explore and we develop the space economy, we drive the cost of these things down, and it's exciting to have Blue Origin with their plans, is that you don't just go there. And in fiction, we like to talk about, oh, you know, those Martians, those skinny Martians with their low body mass and all that. I think when we're an interplanetary species, it's like being an international species. It means that you go there for a couple years, you hop on a ship, and you maybe explore the outer solar system. Maybe you come back to Earth every 10 years or so and spend a couple years here, and we'll have technology for drugs and things like that to improve body mass and deal with bone loss and all these other things. What? That it's not just we go off to become these Martians we forget about. Like, no, you're part of an interplanetary society.
Yeah, that's the other thing is, yes, there is problems with bone density loss when you're in microgravity, but right now the market to develop a drug to combat that is pretty much zero. The moment this start happens, all of a sudden it's like you can make a crap ton of money by selling people the drugs. Like, if you're going, are you going to Mars? Hey, when you come back, would you like your bones to not be brittle and falling apart?
Well, Brian, I'm going to take the opposite approach, and I'm going to say that actually there's a huge market for that right now with osteoporosis, but the fact that if you have a Martian mission with that and you have a specific need, you'll have research and data points you can get there. If you want to develop that drug, Mars is going to be a great place to do that because you're going to have tons of really healthy people that need to be part of these clinical trials.
Good point.
Which you can find out more about that in my book, How to Make Money on Mars,
so
a guide to Martian economics.
It's already out.
But pre-ordered now, because we have reached peak Andrew Main. Of course, Andrew has already written a book about the Martian economics.
Hey, so real quick, in the chat room, people are asking, why not the moon? And I think the short answer is, we'll never terraform the moon. We'll never, I guess some number of people would live there. I don't know. I would reverse it and say, why the moon over Mars? I mean, it is a lot closer. But as Robert Heinlein famously pointed out, once you're out of the gravity well, you're halfway to anywhere. So why not go to Mars?
So my answer to that is that there is the if you want to build a self-sustaining civilization, going to Mars, your Mars is the better candidate, right? And not to say that does not mean that we will not develop the moon. And with this technology, you could take off the booster and the upper stage, and you're not going to need as much fuel to get the spaceship to the moon. It'll land on the moon and be able to come back to Earth. You'll be able to do that, do multiple trips to there. It can go there. And Musk is saying, like, hey, I'm building this to go to Mars. Somebody wants to come along and contract SpaceX to take it to the moon because we're going to have the boosters and the tankers on Earth. Sure, it's not saying no to the moon. It actually makes the moon even more accessible now. But part of the reason you want to go to Mars is Mars has just about everything you could need. You know, when we found water, when NASA's probes found water on Mars, understand that, like, for every cubic meter of dirt on Mars, there's about 2 liters of water. That was a big deal breaker. Once we found the water on there, that became, you know, accessible. The moon has water too. What the moon does not have is really any large amounts of nitrogen. And if you want to grow crops and you want to do these other things, you need nitrogen. So the nitrogen we're going to need there, we're going to have to bring. The moon has tons of aluminum, you know, has other materials for building things. But when it comes to, you know, basically nitrogen, that's going to be the thing. It's a deficit. And so you're going to have to import that and recycle that. But the exciting thing about the moon is we think that underneath the moon, there might be lava domes, these giant chambers that are big enough to put a city like Philadelphia inside of.
Wow.
But also the problem with the moon for long term is you're talking, you know, 14%, you know, 15% gravity. So your bone loss and material loss is going to be much, much greater, and it's going to be, you know, harder. But we talked about before on the podcast, like, how you could even terraform the moon. But, you know, terraforming is a far out discussion.
Sure.
Well, the answer is the moon. Yes. If we're going to Mars, we will be going to the moon, and we'll be able to live on the moon too. The answer is you get everything. This is not an either or proposition, which has been the problem before. Is like, if we spend $25 billion to go here, you had to choose. This means if we pick this target and we go there, the technology and the infrastructure makes everything accessible. And Musk was trying to point that out by showing spaceships on other worlds besides Mars.
That's the thing. This is not the story of conquering Mars or finally establishing a tether between the two worlds. This is the story of conquering the gravity well. Like, this being at the bottom of this well has a lot of benefits, but it also it makes the ability to cheaply get anything out off of this world is a total game changer. There's no reason that we can't just go anywhere.
I just want to point out, just to think about this. Jaime pointed out, Tensor Guy pointed out, he says he liked the moon for building ships. Moon has aluminum raw materials, but the problem is like, yes, it's easier to get them into orbit, but you don't have the fuel to do that if you're using methane, if you're using those things. So if you're using more exotic fuels, you know, helium-3 or deuterium or some sort of other kind of stuff, yeah, but it's not just about the hardware. It's also, great, we built it on the moon. How do we get this off and send it off to the rest of the space? Earth has got wonderful infrastructure, and you know, I've heard things like Mars could be like they could grow food to feed space miners. And it's like, all right, that's the most low profit, low yield thing, growing it in the most resource constrained environment on the planet. That's just economic silliness.
Yeah.
Not to say building things on Mars is silly, though.
One last thing.
I like that clear.
In his presentation, Elon Musk made a case for, like, what kind of fuel, if you're going to do a return trip, what kind of fuel do you use? And he compares kerosene versus hydrogen oxygen mix to deep cryomethalox. And basically he says, what do you got to work with on Mars? You've got CO2 in the atmosphere, and you've got H2O in the soil. And so you could make kerosene, which is very difficult to make in that situation. You could distill just the hydrogen and oxygen from the water, but that's something you have to keep very, very cold, and it tends to, you know, boil off very easily. But if you combine it with the CO2 from the atmosphere, then you could get CH4, one hydrogen, four carbons is methane, and then O2, and the combination of those would be a very effective fuel. So I think that's interesting, the idea that you would just send it and just kind of run this automatic, using energy to create this fuel to get off Mars.
Yeah, that was Musk has looked very deeply at these problems. He's had engineers and his teams really looking at these. What's the ideal thing? And a lot of people are like, we think hydrogen containment on Earth is really challenging because it's close to absolute zero. Hydrogen leaks through everything and it's very, very problematic. So he went with methane. And it's funny, like in the plan would be you would build a processing plant on Mars and it would use solar panel power to do that. Ideally, you would use, nuclear power. That was because Andy Weir's like, well, he should be using nuclear. Like, yeah, Elon Musk would like to. But in our world where you have to get the permission from the government and people to allow you to do that, that could be a deal breaker. And he does not want those deal breakers to stop this from happening.
Right.
Or to his plan be contingent on government approval. Right. Which is,
yeah, because that's something that can be given and also taken away. Right.
Yeah. It's going to need, I mean, it's not going to happen without a lot of government participation. And what's exciting is that they start the first Mars mission is 2018, where they're going to send the Red Dragon spacecraft to Mars. NASA is going to allow SpaceX to use the deep space network to help communicate with that. NASA is very interested in finding out how the aerocapture is going to work because it's going to be the heaviest object that's ever been put on Mars. If it makes it, there's a 50% success rate of getting things to Mars. There's going to be levels of participation, and that can be just technology transfers. It could be funding. It could be many, many different things, but it's going to be, they're going to be critically involved in aspects of it. And I hope more and more. So, I mean, I think that I would love for the first mission to have, maybe be contracted by NASA or at least have a good portion of NASA payloads and NASA's, astronauts, space workers working there.
Just one little ancillary thing that Elon Musk went on to mention during his presentation was the use of the reusable rocket technology, not only to, have this railway to Mars effectively, but also that the technology would be beneficial for just terrestrial travel. He mentioned that going from New York City to Tokyo, that it would take you more time getting on and off the capsule than it would to get you to the other side of the planet.
Can I just address that? And then, but he pointed out, and it would be ridiculously loud. And he pointed out that you'd have to do it offshore and all that. And I think that he was sort of, that was an Elon Musk theoretical, but I do think that may have been potential who spends billions of dollars every year on stuff that could fund something like this. Near the military.
Sure.
And
that's what I was going to say is that, that this is a very, very, very highly profitable technological, breakthrough. So for me, I guess I found some of the conversation around this, a little less interesting when it was focused on the idea of who's going to pay for it? And why would this be, this is going to be too expensive. And now he's going to need to cozy up to these governments to be able to do it. And it's no, I don't think so. I think what he's saying is that we are now at a point where all of this rocket technology is dawning into a world where a lot of people can play along with it and a lot of people can build businesses on top of it or revolutionize or streamline their businesses because of it. And that makes the access to capital just a totally different game than how we've thought about space ever.
Things to think about when it comes to capitalization. Musk says he'll take $10 billion. Let's say he's off by 50%. Okay, and it's going to cost $15 billion to build that first rocket. And once we see that booster take off, once we see that booster, that minds are going to change. And when we see what he says, the first one he wants to call Heart of Gold, when we see Heart of Gold do its first low Earth orbit missions, this massive, spaceship that can hold 100 people, when we start to see that, assuming no mishaps, when we see these things happen, we're going to start. It doesn't even mean that we've started the first Mars mission. When we see the scale of this thing and we watch this go into space, things change. I watched a presentation by a NASA scientist who was very excited to show the Orion rocket. The first test of the Orion crew capsule. And I was there. I saw that live when the first Orion. And it's cool. It's really, really neat. But it's a neat, linear progression from Mercury to Apollo to Orion, but it's not the same as watching something that's about as, you know, feels like it's the Starship Enterprise, which is when we could see that within the next 4 or 5 years. We could literally the next 4 or 5 years, we can see that. When we start to see, when we get on Facebook or we get on Twitter or Instagram, when Elon Musk, he already tweeted out, showed us a photo of this tank that goes inside of the rocket, an actual functioning pressurized tank that you could put the entire Constellation spacecraft inside of that. That's been built. When we start to see the spaceship construction happen, which construction is going to accelerate in about 18 months to 2 years once they finish primary development on the Falcon 9 rocket. Once we start to see this thing come together, even when it's on the ground, it's going to get exciting.
So let's talk about that time frame. When would then be now?
So Bryce, if you want to pull up, and by the way, if you go to spacex.com/Mars, you can watch the presentation, and they also have a PDF of all the slides that were presented there. And he gives a time frame, and Musk points out, makes a joking reference that he hasn't always been good with time frames. And the thing to understand is that a Musk time frame is, it's not divorced from reality. It's based purely on the spreadsheet. If this happens at X point, if this happens at X point, it happens here. What you can't put in there are all the externalities, like, yes, if we put a rocket on the pad in September and we have some sort of fueling anomaly and the thing blows up, you don't know those things are happening. It's hard to account for them. What you can say is, best case scenario, this happens. Best case scenarios never happen, but they at least give you a framework to say, this is our goal. So what he has is, next quarter, they want to test the Falcon Heavy, and they've been wanting to test Falcon Heavy for several years. They initially, 10 years ago, they thought they'd be testing it, you know, 5 years from then, and that's not happened. And hopefully that Falcon Heavy, which is the Falcon 9 with two other engines strapped on either side, they want to test that next year. Next year also begins the test of Crew Dragon, which is the ship that will take astronauts to the International Space Station. The Red Dragon mission, sending the first Red Dragon to Mars, happens in 2018, just a little over a year from now. We're going to be sending the largest payload ever to Mars. He has in 2018 also ship testing being testing the first stage, the upper stage of the spaceship. And Musk, in a Muskism, pointed out, said, yeah, you know, and it's totally stripped down like tanker format, you know, it could actually get to low Earth orbit without a booster. You wouldn't be able to get it back down. And it's like, yeah, you know what else you can't get back down? The International Space Station. There could be a market just for that thing to self-launch itself as a platform that they could be built inside of. So he has 2018 for ship testing, 2019, okay, 3 years from now, you know, mid-2019, 3 years from now, booster stage, when we get to see something bigger than the Saturn, well, it'll be the most massive rocket system ever by a factor of five, going off and testing, going up into orbit, then landing back down on Earth. He has 2020 orbital testing. Okay, so 2 months from now, we get to say in 3 years, they want to start orbital testing of that rocket system. Moving forward into the time frame, he sees the launch of the first rocket is, I believe, 2024 would be in this time. Again, in this extremely ambitious estimate, he sees, 2022, that's the first time. Late 2022 is when we have our next transfer window. We'll either be sending another Falcon 9 with a Red Dragon or a Falcon Heavy with a bigger payload, or that's when we could begin the first mission, could launch in 2022, 2023 is when we could be launching people to Mars.
I just wanted to point out a few dates. November 6th, 2020. Okay. That is 3 years from when Elon Musk, again, in an ambitious timeline, says that we could be going to Mars. Marvel has already staked out a movie to come out.
Ha! Yes.
That's untitled, but that is the latest that a Marvel movie has been, like, is on a schedule to come out. Star Wars, the latest Star Wars would be Star Wars Episode 9. That is May in 2019, which I think this is older, so it, that might also wind up being later. But we're talking... This is, by the time that we get to next year, we will have movies in these franchises slated for when this would happen.
Yeah.
Like,
now we're, And do we, what is the probability of meeting those timelines? Very low. Very, very low. Very, very low. But let's add 10 years. Let's double or triple the estimates of that stuff. We still have the most amazing space architecture that's been presented to us ever happening, you know, in, let's say it happens in the 2030s. NASA has this maybe a Mars mission or a flyby in the 2030s. This is actually getting us on the ground 10 years before then. But at the worst case scenario, we have a reusable architecture that happens there. And again, when it comes to funding, people pointed out, you know, the rapid development of robotic cars that came out of nowhere. And now that we're actually seeing on the streets, California may actually change the laws and allow you to have people, you know, driverless electric cars, meaning you can sit in the back. How much is Uber funded for? Not Uber's market value, but Uber's actual private capital funding is $14 billion. That is, holy Uber has cow. Been given $14 billion to be Uber. What is the future of space worth?
Wow, that's profound.
Infinite. No, literally.
No, I mean,
I'm going to sell it to you right now.
It's literally all the money.
Yep. To think about this in comparison, this is an example I put in my book, The Economics of Mars, is in 1970, a couple really critical things happened. We're in the middle of the Apollo program, which was costing like, was that year, those dollars was like $25 billion. 1971, Intel unveiled the microprocessor, and they came up with it because they had a Japanese company, Bizicom, wanted them to develop a calculator chip, but Intel says, you know, there's not enough money in us developing this special chip, and an engineer by the name of Fagnini, I think his name is, said, you know what, I guess if we make the processor reprogrammable so it can do other functions, then we could sell it to them. We won't make much money from them, but then we can sell it to other clients. And Intel engineers invented the microprocessor, the first commercially available microprocessor, 1971. Before the end of the 70s, Microsoft was born and Apple was born, all on that technology. Today, you have a company like Facebook, which I challenge you to explain to anybody in 1970 terms what it does and justify it. Facebook has a market cap, meaning all the total value of the stock, worth $400 billion. $400 billion is half of the entire federal budget in 1970.
Wow.
And that's one. And that was a company started 10 years ago by one dude sitting in his dorm, you know. What is the value of a space economy when we think about all the different spin-out technologies, all the things of solving the problems of space, not just the things we bring back Earth, but the problem of space exploration, all that. Yeah, I think a $14 billion investment, you know, and for the people directly making the investment, the venture capital firm doing that, they will probably see some really good return if they invest in the right sectors and area. So,
I mean, and then there's also the fact that Elon Musk is who he is. Right? That yeah. There is a legendary class of old world titans in the world of venture capital called the PayPal Mafia, for which he is among them. Like, if there is anybody with connections and access to this kind of money, it's Elon Musk, right?
Yeah. And a thing to think about, too, is that he's worth $12 billion now. His net worth is like doubled over the last 10 years. And as this project doubles, just by those two companies, his net worth will probably substantially increase. He has another company that is in development stage that he talked about and then he went quiet about. And I know people who are indirectly involved financially, let's say, with that, and they look at the projections on this and they say it's an earth changer. And that is basically using his low Earth orbit access, his technology he has now, to build his own satellite communication system that would be faster than fiber optic. And when he's a guy who can provide internet service to people on a global scale, what is his net worth then?
When he's also a international telecom conglomerate.
Yeah. So, listen, man. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not saying this thing is a definite thing. I'm not saying there aren't deal breakers there, but I'm saying people are worrying about the wrong things. Agreed. And the answer is, like, how do you do faster than fiber optic? It is because the fiber optic isn't speed of light. Fiber optic, the light has to bounce around back and forth through it from one to the other. But when you're low Earth orbit, you're essentially line of sight. So it would have a pizza box thing on your house. hit a satellite, boom, beam to another satellite and go straight down. And so ends up being faster than that. So crazy pants.
I think that that's a great way to end it. Crazy yeah. pants. It's, I mean, so. This entire week, I think, was just fascinating to me. I know, you know, there was an element that, that you know, I think hopefully we tried to discuss here in terms of some of the criticism on it. But, you know, it ultimately, I think my opinion is more and more where Brian is, where it's just like, hey, listen, dude, I hear you. You're talking, man, that's a lot of crazy trash you're talking. But like, either you coming or not, like, is this a thing that you want to happen? Do you want it to happen now? And I can understand, listen, the internet was made for pornography and bitching about movies, as Kevin Smith once taught us. And I'm sure that that can expand to rocket plans. But at the same time, one dude's doing it. And we can take bets on whether or not it will happen.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing, is like all the bitching and crabbing and complaining and theoretical and you haven't thought of this and you should have done all that. You know, it's like I just picture all those things being said and me sitting there with a notepad and a pen saying like, so what you're saying, not this trip. You don't want a seat. Okay, got it. I'll be back again. We'll talk later. And then, you know, at some point they'll buy a ticket.
Yeah, the point was Musk wanted to come out and say, we've got an infrastructure, we've got a technology, I'm already committed every single resource I have to making this happen. Who else wants to be a part of this? And people are like, well, you have this problem you have to solve. Yeah, that's why he announced this, because he wants other people solving these problems. And people have treated it like he's announced this vacation, you know, destination. And they're like, I don't know. Well, what's the plumbing going to be like? And it's like, oh, we don't know, you know, but it's like Intel announces the microprocessor and now you can build these things on top of it and create wealth. You know, Tim Berners-Lee makes the internet accessible via the World Wide Web. And then you get Mozilla, the browser that makes it accessible for non-academics. And you can look at that. I mean, you look at all the internet people were like in the 90s are naysayers, you know, and it's just a catalog. What's it going to be for? What's it going to be? Is it really generated wealth and blah, 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 blah. It's like, you know what? It's fine. We're going to go set out the problem. We're going to solve these problems and we're going to have fun.
Yep.
Here is the only postscript that I think I remember having a conversation with Andrew about that I would love to bring here. And that is the idea of the space startup, the idea of the Martian startup is something that I predict that within 6 months, I'm going to be at some party or a game night or something out here in the Bay Area, and somebody's going to tell me that they left their job at Facebook or Google to start a startup or to work with a startup that is based on the idea of either space or Mars specifically. I think that's something that if you look at how many companies are started on far more specious hunches, like with you know, minimal market comparatively, I think that without a doubt is going to happen.
Hypothetically, one of the members of our podcast team here may have been asked to go present to a startup accelerator because they mentioned some aspect of space tech or whatever that got a science technology accelerator very interested.
It's Brian, and he's waiting.
Could be. Not naming names. So yeah, I think it's absolutely, you're going to hear. You're going to get like whenever you get like some big thing, whether it's you had like the iPhone app announced the App Store, right? And you got the app funds. There was like a fund says we're going to start an app fund and we want to start taking meetings to talk about this and that. And so, yep, it'll happen. And it will. And then, you know, still it's and the mockery will completely stop. No, it'll only get louder. It'll yep. only get louder.
Yep. Hey, man, we have a conundrum. We're at, an hour and 15 minutes, hour 20 minutes already. Are we going to plow through everything? What are we going to do? We gonna push on our Journey Quest moment for next week?
I think we push Journey Quest to next week, okay?
Well, we'll return on our epic struggle. And by the way, if there's ever a week to take a week off from Journey Quest, this is it. Apologies to everybody who thinks we talk too much about space. We got our head in the stars, and this was like an epic dream come
true.
No
apology at all. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry.
Yeah.
No, Liz, if anything, we should apologize for other weeks where we talk about space this much. I think this week you get a pass when somebody announces a realistic framework to Mars.
Fair enough.
Yeah,
Fair
I... Enough. I I listen, I mean, if it's not your thing, that's fine. But it's one of those things. There are moments in history where you go back and you go, that was really, really, really exciting. That was amazing and stuff. And if you're into things that are cool and you're into science and technology in the future. And I think a lot of people, you know, it's still this, man, Mars, I've heard this sort of thing. It's like, listen, I'm not telling you it's the most important thing that's happened in your life. No, I'm going to flat out tell you, this is the rest of the 21st century is going to be about two things: artificial intelligence and space exploration.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. 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 Agreed. 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 All right, man. What about picks? What do we got in the way of picks? There's a lot going on. I call dibs on Luke Cage. Luke Cage is my pick. It's a real, real good show. It's about a guy whose name is Luke and he's in a cage. The cage is his Harlem. It's amazing, dude. It's a really, really great show. Enjoying it quite a bit.
All his rage, he's still just a guy called Luke Cage. I watched the first two episodes. I really, really liked it.
Yep, same here.
It kind of made me think, like, why there hasn't just sort of been a blaxploitation series. Yet.
Well, and by the way, not that it's really blaxploitive. It's actually a really interesting meditation. Like, I never thought I would hear the N-word so many times in a Marvel property, and about what it, you know, he's wearing a hoodie. It's on the record that they very much wanted to evoke Trayvon imagery on that stuff, and the relationship of, you know, two episodes in, it looks like the main villain is essentially a black councilwoman who is a racist and wants to keep Harlem black. And I don't know. It's really fascinating that this is the place we're at in this in these emerging comic book related franchises.
Yeah, well, I mean, by black exploitation, I mean like that genre of cinema, right? That emerged from the 70s of the strong black hero that sticks it to the man and takes care of his own community that oftentimes could be preying on itself. So, I mean, listen, it's a very socially conscious show. I don't think it really distracts from it. In fact, I think if you really, at least the two episodes that I've seen, there is a couple slate think pieces that I think we will see eventually about this show, because it has some very interesting things to say.
I'm just curious how, if they're ever going to reveal how Remy Danton turned so evil when he went from DC to, the bad guy's Remy Danton? Remy Danton?
Denton, from House of Cards. It's not a spoiler, Andrew. It's just,
not a spoiler. No spoiler. It's not a spoiler. The actor who plays the bad guy played another guy. That's the joke I was making.
I also love, it's one of those things that whenever there's a show like that, that has like such a gigantic black cast, you're like, oh my God, they just got all the same actors from like The Wire and Spike Lee movies. And then it's like, oh no, wait, it's just because these are the people that always get cast when they need more than three black people in a show. It's like, you just have these like really amazing, awesome people that, that just continue to work. But it's great. It's great to see them. I love the show so far.
Is that your pick too, Justin?
Sure. Yes. Yes, it's my pick. Oh, my pick is come see me. I'm doing a live show in London on the 6th. It's going to be another house show. So email me, justinrobertyoung@gmail.com. Put London in the subject line if you are in the UK. So that's this week. It'll be a combined jury/politics live show. So come and see me, because I'll be in London.
My pick is, you all get your ass to Mars. By Mars, I mean spacex.com/Mars. Watch the presentation there. Watch the presentation. Just it's granted, Elon Musk's presentational style is, you know, that of an engineer in many respects, but he's very, very earnest and sincere. There is a Q&A that's not part of it, because it was probably one of the most painful question and answer sessions you could imagine, where, you know, you had number of people who just wanted to, like, you dread the Q&A. Like, when you go to like entertainment stuff, you'll get people like, hey, yeah, I've written a script and it's called blah, 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 and da, 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 da. And they're like, it's not a question. It's somebody just trying to like self-promote. You had several people doing this. You had some guy, several attempts at humor that were just very, very painful. But there was in the Q&A, there was an earnest point where they're asked like Elon Musk if he wanted to be the first man on Mars or whatever. And Musk just has to stop because he's just, he's wrestling with this question himself. And it's, you just get a sincere Musk moment. But the actual presentation itself, the body of the presentation, it's very visual. There's a lot of neat stuff. There's a lot of sort of things that it's not aimed at a super, he tried to scale it not quite to engineers because he was hoping the Q&A would ask the really technical questions.
Yeah.
Which did not happen, yeah. Which is probably some of the reasons the critics should have maybe given him a little more slack, is that he'd open it up to like, hey, ask me the hard stuff and all that. But anyhow, that hour and a half presentation, or at the very least, watch the 4-minute video. And people, like, one of the very dismissive sort of things we got pointed to, oh, is computer animated Folly or whatever. No, that's actually based in the CAD renderings of the real technology they're building right now. This is a rendering based from engineering drawings, not Musk saying like, oh, make the rocket bigger. Oh, cool. So
watch that. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff there.
And a self-shameless plug for my book, How to Make Money in Mars, A Guide to Martian Economics, available now for pre-order on Amazon. And by the way, the book's going to be larger. Like, Amazon listed like 44 pages. It'll be like 120 or something like that. But, a concise thing. I had to upload like the draft version of it, but it'll be a much fuller sized book. So not boring. Well, I mean, it depends on your proportion, but I get into just a lot of historical examples and explain, you know, where innovation has driven economic growth, how companies have pioneered and been able to do very well early stages on different sorts of things, and try to make a very solid case. And I don't break it down to like, yeah, and tourism, you know, and, you know, some other silly, and we discover this magical material, or if we find life. It's based on much more grounded examples.
I can't wait to read it. So get it to me before I have to fly to Tenet.
Yeah. Well, there's that. So, gentlemen,
mm-hmm.
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.